Hello everyone, and welcome to Foil Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics. I'm your host, Andrew, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Rob.
Hello!
And Mick.
Hello!
So guys, how are you today?
I'm dry for the first time in a week. It has not rained on me once today.
It's surprisingly sunny outside.
For it Britain, is. In June.
I don't trust it.
It'll never last.
But yes, since it is such a surprisingly seasonable day, what better time to talk about The Dark Knight?
Indeed.
Hey, it's a good segue. I like it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, recently we've had a whole bunch of sort of rumours, but at the moment there are things that have been quote-unquote confirmed about Matt Reeves' upcoming Batman project, which will, of course, have Rob Pattinson as the Batman himself. I think it's a pretty cool casting choice.
I really don't.
I don't know. I'm of two minds. I can see why it might be a good casting choice, but I can also see why it wouldn't.
Is it because he's a talentless lump of wood?
In quite a few things, yes.
Yeah.
But also, I just can't see how he's going to pull off the Bruce Wayne persona.
And that's the problem. You can have a talentless piece of wood in the Batman costume.
Yeah.
You can't have a talentless lump of wood playing Bruce Wayne.
Yeah. I mean,
I can see him as kind of like a brooding, sleep-deprived Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, but I mean,
that'd be more like comatose.
That's what only one side of Bruce Wayne. What about all the social occasions, stuff like that? I mean, in the words of Tony Stark, a billionaire playboy philanthropist. He's supposed to be charming. He's supposed to be dating, like, several women. His whole persona is supposed to be the complete opposite of Batman.
Yep.
Right, I'm going to kick this off by saying something very controversial then.
Oh?
I don't think that's really that necessary in a film version of Batman. Like, I feel like... No, I think you can have a good Batman film. Like, I think we'd know... Yeah, if you want to shut up, Rob. Yeah. Like, I think we can have a Batman film that is more about Batman. Like, it's kind of like the... like how Spider-Man films now, a lot of them haven't really gone that much into, like, Uncle Ben's death. One of those things that I feel like there's enough cultural awareness that you don't necessarily need to shoehorn it into a film.
Okay, that's a fair point.
But I think with Batman, the Bruce Wayne bits, they raise the stakes a little bit, because it's difficult to keep the fact that you're Batman a secret if you also have to be visible as Bruce Wayne, if you see what I mean.
I don't know, you say it raises the stakes. I always find it just kind of a step too, because when does he sleep?
That's kind of the point of him, isn't it? He burns the candle at both ends. And he's a billionaire. He just gets up late.
And to be fair, they have portrayed that side of him. He's a billionaire, but he's not a businessman. It's not like Tony Stark, who's running a business.
True.
All I'm saying is, this is just going to be one of the many items on my list of 100 reasons why Batman should definitely be dead by now.
On that, I think we all agree.
Yeah. I mean, he's pushing 80.
I think I made the point when you were covering the death of Daredevil. Daredevil's basically Batman without the budget.
It's not healthy, Bruce. Me and Alfred are worried about you. Just have a nice sleep, a nice bowl of chicken soup.
I think Bruce is probably more than aware that Alfred is worried about him.
I think it was in one of the Batman movies where Alfred starts telling him off about how he doesn't look after his health. And all you got is, I can't remember which Batman movie it was, but the guy playing Bruce Wayne just looked really sheepish.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely a lot of Michael Caine being all, oh, go on, kill yourself, Master Wayne.
Yeah, that was it.
That wasn't Michael Caine at all.
I know.
There are Michael Caine impersonators out there thinking, you have brought shame to our profession.
Once again, it's a spectacular guest appearance by the man of 1,000 voices, none of which are the one he was going for.
Is that one of Batman's villains?
No, but thank you for the segue, because one of the big things about Matt Reeves' Batman that's come out is there are apparently going to be 6 different villains in roles of varying importance.
Oh, no.
I feel like it's possible to have a film with a lot of villains in, just as long as you don't try and make all of them of equal importance. Spider-Man franchise.
Particularly Spider-Man 3.
Batman franchise.
Which one?
Well,
oh,
Batman.
Batman and Robin.
Batman and
Batman
Robin.
Forever.
Batman Forever.
Oh, God.
Batman Returns to a degree.
Well, no, Batman Returns worked to a degree because Catwoman wasn't really a bad person. She wasn't really a villain.
But it only worked to a degree because she had origin stories for Catwoman,
yeah.
Penguin, Max Schreck.
Yeah, who really didn't look like he did in the DreamWorks film.
Anyway, what makes me slightly hopeful for this is some of the villains are very obviously, there's some who are going to be important to the film, some who are just going to be kind of in one scene or maybe cameos, and then some who, the idea is I think they want to set up to be more of a thing in the future. So we shall go through this list. First up, we have Firefly, who will of course be played simultaneously by Nathan Fillion, Jewel State, Adam Baldwin, Alan Tudyk, Gina Torres.
Shiny.
Finally, the film in which Batman fights a spaceship.
See, you call it a spaceship, it's probably just like a Volkswagen Beetle as a getaway car called Serenity.
Funny you say Beetle, because Firefly's whole thing is he does dress up like a Firefly. His name is Garfield Lyons. He was a pyrotechnics expert. And like so many people in the just... Really, Batman comics are like a commentary on the state of the economy, aren't they?
Yes.
He was forced to use his skills to turn to crime as a serial arsonist.
Okay.
Taking into account your comment about villains being a comment on social, economic, real-world problems, the thing is, when Firefly first appeared, it was probably the case that there wasn't much money for visual effects and pyrotechnics. But now you've got the Marvel Cinematic Universe, there'd be loads of work for him. It'd be in high demand.
Oh my God, that'd be excellent if Firefly just went to work for Marvel.
Yeah.
So, I don't know any of the villains that are going to be in this movie. I haven't checked on it since I found out Robert Pattinson was going to be Batman,
which is the biggest villainy of all.
We'll see. I'll cut him some slack.
Exactly. I feel like I came across as a bit maybe too pro Pattinson earlier. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
But we've got Firefly, who I like. Firefly. He's not really a character who's got that much in the way of character. He's got a cool design and a big flamethrower, and that's really all I need in a character.
Okay.
Then we also have the Mad Hatter's going to be in the film apparently.
See, the Mad Hatter's one of those weird Batman villains who he's a bit more prominent than he needs to be, but he's not really like A-list Batman villain.
I liked him in Gotham when he was apparently played by Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen.
Sure.
I actually could see that working as well. I could picture that totally. Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen is the Mad Hatter. He comes in and he redecorates your house. What villainy is this? Why would you put purple and gold on my walls?
See, Mad Hatter's really weird, though, because he's, like, balanced on this very fine line of being, like, it's a ridiculously designed character. He's just, like, a short, buck-toothed guy dressed as the Mad Hatter from Alice in Wonderland. And his gimmick is he has special mind control hats. But then he's also obsessed with a woman called Alice and wants to, like, place her under his control and make her a bride, and he's actually kind of super creepy. Like, even as a kid, Mad Hatter always creeped me out a bit.
Yeah, he is like Stalker Man, isn't he?
He's super Stalker Man.
They did play with that in the Gotham series as well, because it was his sister, was Alice.
Oh.
And she was one of the people he controlled.
Oh, that's worse.
Mm.
I've been this film, Mad Hatter appears in like one scene and gets pushed off a bridge. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's Batman's staunch no killing unless the kind of weird rule. And just a bit awkward.
Yeah, I forgot about that Batman rule. Okay, can I take a guess? Is the Ten-Eyed Man going to be in?
No. Sadly, podcast favourite, the Ten-Eyed Man, is not going to be in the film.
Damn.
What about King Tut?
King Tut. He was... Is this your as-threatened list of villains who appeared in the TV series?
Yes.
And are of questionable canonicity?
Yes.
I think... Is King Tut canon?
I believe he is.
Because I remember...
He was definitely made for the TV series.
Yeah.
And then I think was later kind of used in a few issues.
Because I think he once did like some kind of evil partnership, criminal partnership with Max's use.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's probably the reason why he's not been as big a thing in the comics. He's essentially just Maxi Zeus, but Egyptian themed.
Yeah.
Not that being obvious knockoffs have stopped a lot of the Batman villains.
So what about Egghead?
To the best of my knowledge, Egghead hasn't been in the comics. I feel like because no mere like pencil and ink illustrator can capture the majesty of Vincent Price.
This is true. This is absolutely true. Okay, so let's just run through the rest of the villains from the movie before we get to the truly weird ones.
Yep, so apparently playing bigger roles in the plot, we have got a trifecta, kind of Batman's biggest villains, Riddler, Penguin, and Two-Face.
Okay.
Which, I'm curious, because Riddler could be fun. He's apparently going to be, like, the main villain. I think, with this apparently being based off the comic book of the Long Halloween, he might be kind of trying to play various villains against each other.
Okay. Because
that was sort of what he did in that series.
I'll be honest, which one was it? Was it Batman and Robin that had Jim Carrey as the Riddler and Tommy Lee Jones as Two-Face?
That was Batman Forever, I think.
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah, because that was about him becoming Robin, and then so the next film was Batman and Robin.
Ah, right, okay. Because I got confused, because I try and separate them by remembering which one had the bat nipples. I honestly thought Jim Carrey was pretty good as the Riddler. He was the only good thing about that film. Because Tommy Lee Jones was basically just the Joker with a scarred face.
Yeah, I can see Jim Carrey was kind of like very cartoony Riddler.
Yeah.
He was more in line with the Frank Gorshin portrayal, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And to be fair, I did love that Riddler. I guess maybe a lot of that was just because people were coming off the Tim Burton Batman movies.
Yeah.
It was a bit of whiplash.
There were just some lovely moments with Jim Carrey as the Riddler. In the bit where he meets, I've forgotten who was playing, Val Kilmer playing Batman in that one, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
That's weird to think about now.
I know. But that whole scene where you have Edward Nygma meeting Bruce Wayne, and all he's done, he's basically just tried to copy Bruce Wayne as much as possible, right down to the glasses.
So that is one of the best ridiculous supervillain names, isn't it?
Yeah.
Edward Nygma.
Exactly. Yep. So who's the final one then?
Well, and finally, we'll have perhaps unsurprisingly Catwoman, who I feel is probably more going to be sort of an anti-hero rather than a villain.
Yeah.
She should probably steal some stuff, do a bit of flirting with the Batman, and then scamper off.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to see a movie where that duplicity is kind of played out properly, because I don't think they've ever really done that side of Catwoman's character justice in the movies.
I don't know. Michelle Pfeiffer played it pretty well.
Kind of, but then...
Yeah, I think it'd be nice to have a Catwoman who just, like, steals things because she likes to steal things.
Yeah, rather than it being a... Because with Pfeiffer, it was mainly a revenge thing, wasn't it?
And with What's-Her-Face in The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, and Anne Hathaway, it was more boring, the rich are bad, but maybe they're not. Maybe the poor are the real bad ones.
Yeah, when the villain's struggling to when the villain's struggling to understand their mate.
Sorry, what was that? You're both talking at the same time.
So that was just me slipping into my by now famous Bane impression.
Oh, I thought you were doing Michael Caine again.
To be fair, I guess that is. They are equally. They could be either. They're equally Bane and
either way, it's like they're both in the room.
And what you were saying, Mick.
The problem with Anne Hathaway's Catwoman is if the villain herself is struggling with her motivation, then how are we supposed to keep track?
It's true.
She was just a bit diluted for me, Catwoman, played by Anne Hathaway. I don't think it was Anne Hathaway's fault. It was just the character didn't have much going for her, as written.
Okay, so...
Yeah, I think it could be fun to maybe, like, have a movie where it starts and she's just, like, just a thief in the first movie.
Yeah.
And then, like, maybe becomes a bit more heroic in the sequels. I think that would be, yeah, a fun arc.
Weirdly enough, isn't that how they portrayed her in Gotham?
Yeah. Yeah, she was just out for herself all the time and always doing this hard street kid sort of portrayal.
Yeah.
Until it actually got down to the nitty gritty and, you know, when it looked like no one cared whether Bruce Wayne stuck around or not, she was the one who was, like, deeply hurt by his intention to move out of Gotham. So, it's another fine portrayal of the duplicitous side of Catwoman. And I think the way that they portrayed the Riddler as a complete split personality to the point where at one point he was a bit more like King Tut, where if he got struck on the head in a particular way, the bad Riddler came out. But I quite like that. It did remind me a little bit of King Tut, but
I love about Gotham is you keep saying things that make me think, oh, this sounds like kind of like a quite good serious of reinterpretation of Batman, and then it's the Riddler gets bonked on the head and that makes him evil.
It's not quite as simplistic as that, but
it's close enough.
They start portraying it as a split personality thing, and then certain traumatic events will release the evil Riddler.
Oh God, they did. Do you remember Abbott and Costello?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm aware of their work.
Yeah, do you remember the Niagara Falls bit where the guy can't hear the words Niagara Falls without trying to kill someone? It's that, isn't it?
I'm going to say yes if you promise to stop talking.
No.
In that case, no, it's nothing like that.
That the people tune into 4Panel for two things: my spot-on impressions and these timely topical references.
I will have you know, I was being controlled by the ventriloquist.
That's another Batman villain.
Yes, he is.
One who I think is not going to be in this film, or perhaps any film, because he is a man with a ventriloquist dummy, like in it's made to look like a 1920s gangster
called Scarface.
Yeah, and Scarface is the crime lord, and despite being literally the one pulling the strings, ventriloquist is just like his henchman.
Yep. You remember we did that episode about the weird Spider-Man villains? Batman has a cavalcade of just the strange.
Oh, very strange. Speaking of strange, one of the villains I do hope shows up at some point, I'm surprised hasn't yet, is Hugo Strange.
Yeah.
Who is, in the comics, he's a psychologist.
Well, it certainly begins with Psycho anyway.
Wasn't he the main bad guy from Arkham City?
Yeah, exactly. It was like kind of revealed he was pulling the strings and manipulating everyone. And I like that kind of villains, when they can just get in people's heads.
And again, he's a key player in Gotham.
What about the villains who get in people's food?
Oh, right.
Say again?
Am I going to have to talk about the Condiment King?
See, I set that one up for Andrew.
The Condiment King. Yeah. I mean, I remember him from the Lego movie.
He's got special guns, one that shoots ketchup and one that shoots mustard.
But, you know, I want to do this with
mayonnaise,
a proper critical head on, right? I'm aware of Condiment King because he was in the Lego movie, wasn't he? The Lego Batman movie. But outside of the Lego Batman movie, what in the name of all that is holy was going on there?
With the Condiment King?
Yeah.
He is very much a joke villain.
Yeah.
So basically the thing with Batman villains, what tends to happen is a lot of them follow the basic formula of just have a gimmick, and then they're just a guy who uses items based on that gimmick.
Yep.
So like, you've got the Riddler, who of course is all about leaving riddles. And you've got, then I love, okay, just the most blatant ripping off is called the Clue Master. and leaves clues about his crimes. But it's okay, because they're not in the form of a riddle, so it's not the same. Then you've got Polka Dot Man, who his costume is covered in polka dots that he can take off and they turn into items.
Yep.
Which, fine, Polka Dot Man. Fine.
What about Sterling Silversmith? The man who thought silver was going to be the next big thing. So he kept stealing it.
Actually, that reminds me. So, one villain I did want to talk about, because I think we are now just in the talking about random Batman villains portion of the show.
Yep.
Is
what more fun can anybody have?
So, one of the like really weird, super obscure Batman villains is a guy called the Penny Plunderer. And he rode around on a big penny farthing. And, like, all his crimes were just to steal pennies. And it was only in one issue. But the really weird thing about him is, in that issue, he tried to kill Batman and Robin by crushing them under a giant penny. And that's where the giant penny in the Batcave comes from.
So even though he's only in one issue, it just keeps getting referenced every time you see the Batcave.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, it's super weird that, like, one of the most iconic parts of the Batcave comes from this story about, like, this ridiculous one-note villain. Also, do you want to know what happens at the end of that issue?
Oh?
Penny Plunderer gets the electric chair.
Ooh.
Which, again, just is some amazing mood whiplash.
Wow, didn't expect that.
Yeah, early Batman stories were kind of dark.
Yeah. Oh, talking about blatant rip-offs, and this has nothing to do with, like, blaxploitation or 70s disco, but The King of Cats.
Oh, I think. Yeah, and I think, weirdly, The King of Cats is a different character to Catman.
Yep, he is. Because The King of Cats was, wasn't he basically Catwoman, but a guy?
Yeah. Yeah, King of Cats is, like, the male version of Catwoman, who I think, like, wanted to make her his bride, because icky stuff. But then Catman is, like, discount Batman.
Yeah. But King of Cats didn't just steal stuff, he also stole cat-related stuff as well.
Sure, he also had, like, a special cat cloak.
Yeah, and always kept getting beaten up by Batman. Sometimes pretty badly.
Well, it's fine.
It's because Batman never dated him. You know, they didn't have a special relationship.
Actually, really, that's, like, the perfect villain for Batman. Because, obviously, as the King of Cats, he's got at least 9 lives.
Yep.
So, like, Bruce can finally just work out all his murderous impulses. Although I suppose he has an even better opponent for that. The unkillable Lord Deathman.
And isn't that the manga villain?
Yes. The villain who originally appeared in the Batman manga, which was made in Japan. I think DC licensed it.
I just want to clarify. You're on about the Bat manga, not the other two manga versions of Batman that
came. Oh, yes. Sorry, no, not manga, Bat manga. Yeah, so his whole thing was he is a guy who appears to be immortal, but then it turns out he's just using special tricks to, like, stop his breathing temporarily. So everyone thinks he's dead, but then it turns out he is immortal and he's really cool.
Yeah.
So he's just, like, he's basically just wearing, like, a skeleton Halloween costume.
The weird thing is, Japan, in the manga versions of Batman, there's been a couple of manga versions of Batman, and one of them had a great but bizarre villain. It was basically this old guy who was a superhero otaku, and so he was kind of like, you remember the collector, or whoever it is, just collecting rarities. He was kind of like the Earthbound version of that, and he wanted to add Batman to his collection, so he lured him to Japan.
That's weird, but I like it.
Right. Are you willing, Andrew, to fill in the gaps in my knowledge about the TV show villains that I grew up loving?
I am indeed.
Right. Okay. Canon or non-canon? Minerva, as played by Zsa Zsa Gabor.
Pretty sure non-canon.
Mm.
Okay. Kabbalah.
I don't think Kabbalah.
That was another one of the generic attractive ladies, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, just to give you the TV plot. She only appeared once. She opened a health spa in Gotham City and used her deepest secret extractor to run amok.
I'd say non-canon.
Yeah, that one's not canon. Well, is that the episode where it ends with, like, Bruce Wayne taking the lovely lady home and then she invites him in, and he just turns around and says, "Well, man can't live on milk and crime fighting alone." And then just gives a big wink. Because that's the best episode of the Batman show.
All right, next up, Kabbalah, played by Howard Duff. Sorry?
Again, you just said Kabbalah.
Well, you didn't answer on Kabbalah.
We said non-canon. Said,
yeah.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
We did.
But I didn't even give you any background on him. Oh, well.
Wait, is Kabbalah not the one with the health spa?
No, Minerva's the one with the health spa.
Ah.
Kabbalah is more of a sidekick to Cassandra Spellcraft.
That one's definitely, like, both of those are non-canon, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Calamity Jan.
I'm pretty sure that's non-canon.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not aware of Calamity Jan ever being in the comics.
What about the anatomically titled Nora Clavicle?
Surely that's a Monty Python character.
Nora Clavicle used her wits and charm to convince Mayor Lindsay to give her the commissioner job, which is all part of a devious plan to destroy Gotham and collect an insurance claim using mechanical mice.
So she is a Monty Python character.
And she replaced the police force with housewives.
Yep, absolutely a Monty Python character.
Okay, Lady Penelope Peasoup.
That's a Thunderbirds character, isn't it?
No, that's Penelope... I can't remember her name.
I think she was always just Lady Penelope, wasn't she?
Yes, Lady Penelope Peasoup, played by Glynis Johns, and her husband, Lord Marmaduke Fogg.
Those have got to be non-in. if they aren't, I feel like we have to cancel the show.
What? Probably a bit late for that. Olga, Queen of the Cossacks.
Was she canon?
She was Egghead's girlfriend in the show.
Yeah, I remember something about Cossacks in Batman, though. Was there a character called?
The problem there is there's at least like 9,000 villains who are just evil Russian.
No, I mean, I think there was a bad guy. I think DC had a villain called the Cossack.
Probably, but I think Olga, Queen of the Cossacks, is probably non-canon.
Yeah.
Okay. Louis the Lilac.
Non-canon, I'd say.
Non-canon, yeah.
It did appear in 5 episodes of The Brave and the Bold, though.
Maybe not then, because I think they went more for...
They went more for canonical villains, didn't they?
And now another foodie one. A female foil for that pernicious Prince of Perfidy, the Penguin. Lola Lasagna, played by Ethel Merman.
I'd say non-canon.
Her weapon of choice was the parasol. Siren, played by Joan Collins.
Siren. Yeah, Siren, I think, is non-canon. I know there have definitely been other characters in DC Comics called Siren.
Can I...
The one I'm thinking of is more like a mermaid.
Can I jump in with one character that I do want to bring up? Because I don't understand the logic behind it.
Okay.
The Eraser.
Is a guy who erases things.
Yeah. With his head? Was it?
Yeah, because listen here, you mug. It's going to rub you out.
Hold on. Wasn't that a David Lynch film?
No, that was Eraserhead. But, he dressed like a giant.
I feel like Batman 66 meets Eraserhead is the sequel comic I'm not looking forward to.
Yeah, but this guy dressed like a pencil and used the special eraser on his head to remove evidence.
You can see how that would work.
But why dress like a pencil?
Because a pencil typically has an eraser on its head. And if that's what you're going to do...
I mean, the crazy quilt is canon. I can't believe that.
Yeah, not only is the crazy quilt canon, but this a man who dresses in like a multicoloured quilt and fires special coloured lasers was Robin's arch enemy for quite a while.
Yeah, this is true.
What about Black Widow?
I think that's Marvel, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely Marvel. I'm going to say probably non-canon, but there may have been like a few characters kind of with the same name, but unrelated.
The Maid of Wood Killer.
The what?
He's basically a guy with a bat.
No, that's Batman. No, surely. No, no.
He's a guy with a bat who killed the mayor. He's got a baseball bat and he kills the mayor.
Matt, he must have been so annoyed. Like, he spends ages picking out his signature weapon, beats a guy to death, thinks, okay, now time to start my criminal career. Need a name. Got a bat. I'm a man. I'm gonna be. And then Bruce Wayne just swings past the window.
What about Colonel Gum? Two M's.
Oh, of course. Why wouldn't it be two M's?
Who wears pink, mainly?
I'm going to say, I think probably most of this list are going to be non-canon.
Yeah.
Okay. But Sandman, a.k.a. Dr. Somnambula.
Actually, he might be canon.
I think that one's non-canon, even though DC have like 17 different Sandmen.
Yeah, that's why I'm thinking he might have been canon.
Because there was the original Sandman, who was kind of a 1920s hero. Like, he shot people with a special gas gun that made them go to sleep.
Yeah.
Then there's the Jack Kirby Sandman, who is like a weird superhero who protects kids' dreams. Then, of course, there's the Neil Gaiman Sandman.
Who doesn't protect kids' dreams. Instead, you know, appears in comics that can sometimes give you nightmares.
Yeah. Right, not to be confused with the Riddler. Where stand you on the Puzzler?
Oh, now the Puzzler, I think, might actually be canon.
He is. I know the Puzzler's canon. He's one of those weird Riddler clones, like the Clue Man.
I just love how very clearly there are some days when the writers on Batman are just like, right, we'll just do another Riddler.
He's not a patch on one of my favourite strange Batman villains, Kite Man.
Kite Man? Hell yeah.
Kite Man.
Yes.
He's a man, right? And he's got a kite.
He once got defeated by a tree.
Is he nervous around power lines?
And yeah, Kite Man is just amazing. He's just a guy with a kite.
I feel like that's the problem with Tom King, is that his current Batman series peaked very early on, when he just included a random scene where Kite Man bursts through a window at a party, grabs a necklace and just jumps back out the window while screaming, Kite Man, hell yeah.
I've got an image, it's great, from one of the scenes where Kite Man is like, but where Kite Man flies, he flies alone. It's because his hang glider can only carry one person.
Oh, Kite Man. Is that a good place to stop?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, no, I forgot to mention the best thing about the Puzzler.
Oh,
what?
He's not a Batman villain. He's a Superman villain.
Ah.
Oh, yeah, he is, isn't he?
The most powerful being in the world going up against a man who's good at Sudokus.
You know, at some point I am going to have to rewatch this series. Some of these villains are just mental. I mean, Morticia Adams as Marsha Queen of Diamonds.
Excellent.
Walter Slezak as the Clock King.
All I can say is it showed they had range.
Oh my god, I forgot that the TV series had a version of the Clock King.
Roddy McDowell as Bookworm.
My god, I forgot Roddy McDowell was in that.
But yeah, we will take a break here and we'll be back soon with what we've been reading.
Hello, I'm J. Michael Tatum and you are listening to The Geek Show.
Ah, there really is nothing like a first leather-bound edition of a classic Victorian podcast. Hello, we're Literary Loitering from The Geek Show and we cover literally all types of books, from hardbacks to paperbacks to sometimes the words within them. If any of these things interest you, why not pop in and give us a visit on Literary Loitering.
Hello and welcome back to Four Panel and the bit that we enjoy the most, talking about the comics, what we have read with our eyes and that.
I mean, you say that, I feel it very much depends on the comic.
I mean, it does. I mean, we've enjoyed it in comparison to, say, poking our eyes out with hot sticks.
Again, very much depends on the comic.
Yep.
Yeah, but we haven't got any Jodorowsky this week.
So you say.
Oh, don't we, Nick?
Oh, no!
Yes. Anyway, it's me first up. I've got typhoid fever. No, I'm not talking about the disease. This is a trade paperback called Typhoid Fever, written by Claire McLeod, Chapman, with art by Stefano Landini, Will Robson and Danilo S. Bayruth, Paolo Villanelli, colours by Rachel Rosenberg, Donna Sanchez-Almara, and letters by VC's Travis Lanham. And this actually collects Typhoid Fever Spider-Man, Typhoid Fever X-Men, and Typhoid Fever Iron Fist. So, yeah, what is Typhoid Fever? Obviously, if you're talking Marvel Universe, then it can only be Typhoid Mary, who...
Now, that was the best thing for me about Daredevil.
It was Daredevil, wasn't it?
Or was it Iron Fist?
But that was one she was in.
Yeah, Iron Fist Season 2.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. I got confused.
So forgettable, apart from Typhoid Mary.
Yeah.
I thought she was all right. She just wasn't really Typhoid Mary.
No. Typhoid Mary is a lot more powerful than that. So, Mary, quite contrary, this whole thing starts off with what looks to be a scene from a soap opera with a woman saying, "Hold me, Dr. Charles, never let me go. Your touch is everything I could have ever dreamed of." And he's going, "I live only to make every last one of your dreams come true, my darling." Like I said, seems like a scene from some kind of soap opera, romantic drama, but there's, within a few panels, you realize there's something not right here, and then suddenly the guy bursts into flames and throws himself out of a window. Spider-Man catches him and gets pulled into this because Mary is, well, Mary has a split personality. Part of her is Typhoid. The other half is Mary. And right now, Typhoid has all of the power. And Typhoid is angry at being messed around by various doctors, at being messed around by other mutants, at being messed around by so many different people who have, as far as she's concerned, harmed her, hurt her, prodded, poked, never left her alone. In a weird way, this comic depicts her a little bit like a psychic version of Hulk, with her powers amped up by a mutant called Amp. And so Spider-Man gets pulled into her delusions, and soon the entire city, including the X-Men, who've basically appeared to take down Typhoid Mary, Jean Grey tries to take her down, and she basically pits the X-Men against each other, with Jean thinking that Bishop is in love with her, and Storm thinking she has a relationship with Bishop, Iceman just going a little bit nuts with his powers, Spider-Man just in the background doing his thing, and Kurt, Nightcrawler, just popping in and out and just doing other things as well. And then, again, a soap opera thing, because apparently Mary also was on TV. And it jumps around...
I like the word picture painted where Kurt and Spider-Man are just like, I don't know, cooking an omelette or something.
See, this is one of those weird comics where it jumps around and plays around with the panels, the colours, the art style, the scenery, just to try and get across the amount of confusion that's going on in the mind of somebody who is suffering from split personality, and I actually think it works to a degree. And then Iron Fist turns up, and apparently Typhoid has managed to subdue the Mary personality almost completely, and that's when, you know, half her face is white. And so she's taken over a church, killed the priest, and she's basically controlling the nuns. Iron Fist has to try and beat her with his chi powers, which can apparently counteract her amplified mind-controlling powers, which are somehow fire-based and set fire to people. Not sure how that works.
I think I do.
In certain ways, this is interesting, but in other ways, it's you just sit there going, I have no idea what I'm reading. And then I remember it involves mutants, and I think, okay, I'll just try and hold on for the ride. It's bizarre because, on a certain level, I understand, because they're trying to portray Mary as kind of a Hulk character. She just wants to be left alone, and she just wants to learn by herself what her powers mean, everything like that, but everyone else keeps thinking that they know better than her. So on that level, I understand it, and it does make it interesting, but on another level, it's just really, really confusing. So, if you're a fan of the Typhoid Mary character, it's interesting reading. If you're just looking for something to read, though, I'd say there are better things out there. I wouldn't say it's worthy of going in the bin. I'd say there are some parts that made me smile. It's on the charity pile.
Okay. Is it me now?
Yes.
It is indeed.
I've got the Whispering Dark.
I thought Andrew was having throat problems.
No, sorry. I read the title as if it was a stage direction. I've got the Whispering Dark. So this is a Dark Horse comic written by Christopher Emgard, art by Thomas Ayra, and lettering by Mauro Mantella. And it's an odd fish. It's part horror story, part war story. Basically, it tells the story of US Army co-pilot Hannah Vance, who ends up inadvertently as the ranking officer in a group of Army Rangers. The only reason she became an officer was because she wanted to be a pilot, and the only way she could become a pilot was to be an officer. She never actually wanted to command a troop of soldiers. And she goes on a mission to pick up this group of Army Rangers that have been behind enemy lines in some unspecified US-Russian conflict. But it starts off as her having some kind of confessional with her preacher father. And as time goes by, it seems to go into flashback mode, where she's regaling him with the details of this mission to rescue these Rangers from behind enemy lines. And to try and survive in this Russian wasteland, they've got very few supplies. They're surviving on sort of go pills, as they're called. And then it comes to the point where they find a group of young Russian soldiers camping out in the woods, and they have to kill them to get their rations. I mean, initially they want to ambush them to get their rations, but it ends up kind of going pear-shaped, and she gets her first kill as a soldier, if you like. And as she's been brought up as a God-fearing Christian, she has a problem with it. And it's at this point that it's difficult to differentiate between what is reminiscence, what is actuality, and what is a guilt-inspired nightmare scenario. And by the end of the book, where an evil lies in wait to give her the potentially the only freedom she can ever know, you're still not sure at the end of the graphic novel what was real and what was nightmare.
Okay.
And I kind of like it a lot more than I thought I was gonna because of that. When I was reading it initially, it read a bit like it was going to end in a bit of a sort of Predator-style way, but with more of a horror rather than a sci-fi baddie at the end of it. And I thought it was going to be so predictable, and it really turned out not to be. And it's probably only... It's a four-part series that's been collected in this paperback, and it's probably about towards the end of issue one, I think, where you start thinking, is this real? Is this reality? Or is that reality? What's reality? What's happening in the past? What's happening now? What's happening in the future? Have I gone mad? So it keeps you guessing all the way through. And in terms of an exploration of one's deeper fears, one's deeper morality, it's a really gripping. And it doesn't dwell on things. I mean, it's a very short book. I mean, I read it on the journey to work and back in a day. That's how short it is.
Okay.
So it doesn't try to expand it out into some great moral saga spanning volumes 14, 45 to 52. It's four issues that tell a solid story that still leaves you not sure at the end. The artwork isn't the most detailed. It's quite cartoony in places, but like a dark cartoony. If you imagine something that's been aimed at sort of older teens, that kind of artwork. But it's expressive enough. There's some deeply disturbing moments, some deeply disturbing decisions that the characters have to make. If I've got one complaint about it, is that some of the characters in the Army Ranger troop are a little bit cookie cutter characters, you know. There's the tough warrior woman. There's the will save a life at any cost doctor. There's the one who's been driven mad by the horror of it all. They're just that little bit. They don't really, as a troop, get enough breathing space because it's so short. But that's the only complaint I've got. But Hannah Vance, the actual main character, who's the one that's the really important one, really, she's well-rounded. So I'm not going to say it made me grin, but it's definitely, for me, a comic book win.
Okay, cool.
So it's my turn now.
Yeah.
Okay, I've been reading Moonface, which has art by Francois Boucault, and it's written, it's only written by Alejandro Jodorowsky.
No!
So it's like the future, right? Or maybe it isn't. It's at some time on a planet that is reminiscent of Earth, and on the island of Damanustra, the ruling class of Ovian-based tyrants are under constant threat by massive tidal waves that keep threatening to wipe out all life on the island. And in amongst that, the mysterious character known as Moonface has to something-something church, religion, egg, magic garden.
Yep, that sounds like a Jodorowsky.
I mean, look, initially it's not too bad. Like, it's a bit weird, but it makes sense. You know, it's your kind of gritty, futuristic world. Sort of a vague bureaucrat type dude who, the idea is that the ruler of the island originally came there as an egg salesman. And when the island got cut off from the mainland, it was his eggs that kept them all alive, so they made him the ruler. And now he's built this whole sort of egg-based society around it. But he's just your generic kind of corporate bureaucrat, evil dictator type. And, you know, there's people living under his boot heel. There's gangs who live in the sewers and they're getting ready for rebellion. It's all, you know, it's fairly typical of futuristic sci-fi. It's only in the second book when, like, Moonface meets an old preacher guy and starts trying to, like, build a church with his vast psychic powers while the guy yells random bits of scripture that things kind of start to deteriorate. Because it's also one of those things that I feel like is trying too hard to be making all these weird allegorical points about religion and I think the main thing is, like, religion getting corrupted and used as propaganda. But I feel like it spends too much on its kind of arty metaphors where it should be having an actual plot. Because there are just, like, a ton of plots that get brought up and then abruptly kind of just severed.
That sounds like a Jodorowsky graphic novel.
It does.
Like, there's just basically a ton of other groups, like, start their own religions, only to be, like, abruptly killed off. Including, like, this whole mystery involving one of the characters' mothers, which ends up being, like, completely inconsequential. And it's paced really badly as well. Like, it's just, like, we're in the sewers now. Now we're on the run from the army. Now we've escaped. Now we're doing something else. And just, like, bam, 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 without any real breathing room.
You like, see, you thought we exaggerated this, didn't you?
I feel like it's not as bad as, like, the Inkle and stuff.
Or the Meta Baron.
Yeah, or the Meta Baron, because at least this has kind of, like, a grounding in a world of things I can understand, and then sort of branches off into weird directions.
Oh, I understood the Meta Baron for about three panels. Not pages, yeah, panels.
That's what I mean. Like, fundamentally, I can get it's an island. They're being ruled by a dictator. They're getting attacked by tidal waves. Moonface is a weird dude with psychic powers. He can do magic stuff. But it's just a lot. And I feel like the art doesn't help. Because a lot of it is quite washed out. With like panels full of lots of detail. That can be a bit difficult. You have to maybe spend a minute or two working out what's actually going on. But the main thing, I think, the main reason this is going to end up being it's in the bin, is I feel like there's just this kind of undercurrent of things that, to be charitable, I'd say maybe haven't been too thought out. Because there's a lot of, like I said, there's these gangs of people who live in the sewers. And it's implied that they're all made up of kind of groups that society has found unacceptable. So, like, you've got a gang of people who are clearly all like lesbians. You've got a strip, a kind of a brothel full of trans people, which also is bad because the artwork does draw them as just like big, muscly men in dresses, which is not cool.
Mm.
And I feel like that doesn't gel that well with the kind of central message of this book of there is a right way to be doing religion, and it's everyone is very pious in a big church, and we don't question God's will, and everyone has to be nice and obedient. And it's just, you know, it's kind of uncomfortable undercurrent of there is an objectively right way to live your life, and if you don't do that, you're going to go to hell.
So basically it's got overtones of zealotry.
I wouldn't go as far as to say zealotry. It's just this very kind of being the traditional white European Christian is the best way, and there are like no alternative ways of living.
Wow. I really have no response to that.
No.
It's, again, I feel like the problem is I feel like I'm making it sound more like it's kind of stamping down, but I think it's more just a kind of an oversight. Like, it is just, because it is very rooted in this kind of 70s idea of like, all the main characters have to be kind of straight and white. And when we talk about religion, that religion is, of course, just going to be Christianity rather than like any other form of religion. And I just, altogether, it does create these quite uncomfortable overtones.
Okay. Okay. I get it.
Which is sad because some of the visuals are actually like quite impressive. Especially like the way Moonface can kind of like control the waves by just sort of dancing about. Or the ways like he's got like psychic links to various people, so when they get injured, like, you see big things of blood erupting from him, but then they'll like sew back up. It's, that's just a bit iffy. Anyway, I'm done now because I my voice is starting to go.
Okay. So I am taking us out then, quite literally, with,
well, that's a bit harsh, I think.
Yeah, well I've got a bad case of mutants today, and that's only going to get worse because I'm talking about X-Force. The 90s mutant militia is back, it says on the back. And in larger letters than that, it says, teeth gritted and hot for blood. And this collects X-Force issues 1 to 5, which issues 1 to 4 are by Ed Brisson. Sorry, all of them are by Ed Brisson. But the art in issues 1 to 4 is by Dylan Burnett and Juanan Ramirez, with colours by Jesus Abatov and Brian Reber. Issue 5 has art by Damien Cochero and colours by Jesus Abertov. And letters are by VC's Corey Petit. And the issues 1 to 4 are called Sins of the Past and The Big Sleep-In. Issue 5 is called Some 2,000 Years from Yesterday. And this is X-Force after Cable gets killed by Cable. See what I mean about a bad case of mutants?
Mm.
So, Cable has been killed by Cable, who came back in time to take the original X-Men back to their original time, because apparently their existence in the current timeline was destroying all timelines, including Cable's, which is what's depicted in the Some 2,000 Years from Yesterday, when Cable, in this case the young Cable, sees his friends disappearing from existence in front of him. And so he does his body slide by one back in time to find out what the reason is, figures out what the reason is, and teams up with Deathlok, of all people. And so they're in Dragorin, in the country of Transia, where they speak Romanian, and there is a mutant hunt going on by the military in Transia, because they've opened the doors and become a safe haven for mutants, but the army doesn't like that, and they've been given some really powerful guns from 2,000 years in the future. Guess who else is from 2,000 years in the future? That's right. It's Nathan Dayside, is it? Dayspring?
Nathan Charles Dayspring Ascani Summers.
Yeah, that's him. Although he just calls himself Nathan Dayspring Summers in this. He is also from 2,000 years in the future. Do I see a link here? Yes, there is. There is a link between the two. Nathan Dayspring Summers.
Oh, wait, no, I'm terribly sorry. I made a horrible mistake.
Oh?
Nathan Christopher Dayspring Ascanison Summers.
Oh, no worries. Anyway, X-Force are out in force, and X-Force being Cannonball, Boom Boom, Domino, Shatterstar, and Warpath. And they are on the Warpath for the person who killed their version of Cable, because Cable basically made them who they are and was their friend and mentor and everything like that. Meanwhile, the military in Transia is getting their weapons from somebody, and you find out who that somebody is later on. You also find out later on in this why Nathan Dayspring Summers has come back. I'm going to keep calling him that. Or should I just call him NDS? I'm going to call him NDS.
I prefer it because he is the kind of earlier in time, worse version of Cable. He is dial-up.
Okay, yeah, dial-up. Oh, dear. I'm going with dial-up. Dial-up's good. Okay, so dial-up, he's basically been taken in, let's say, rather than captured by X-Force, who have been looking for him, and they want answers. They want to know why Cable was killed when dial-up, or why dial-up killed Cable, which is kind of the reverse of history, as we know. Meanwhile, Boom Boom is late for the party, as always, and also causes a massive explosion, which she does because she's Boom Boom, and that's her thing. Deathlok and Dial-Up decide to team up with X-Force, and they go out to rescue the mutants who are being blamed for killing the president of Transia when it was actually the military in a coup d'etat, because the military leader of Transia doesn't like the fact that his son is a mutant and is turned into an amorphous blob. And you know what?
That's Mr. Gelatinous Blob to you.
Yes, it is. But you know what? Guess who has been supplying the Transian military with weapons from 2,000 years in the future? That's right, you guessed it. It's Ahab, everyone's favourite mutant hater. And what's the male version of a dominatrix?
A dominator.
Yeah, dominator?
Yeah.
He likes to take mutants and turn them into gimps. Tell me I'm wrong, Andrew.
I mean, technically they're called hounds.
What do they dress like?
They dress... Look, who of us hasn't gone hunting and dressed our dogs up in tight latex bodysuits covered in spikes?
With muzzles or zips or things like
that. And also drawn, like, weird lines on their face.
Exactly. Turns out Dial-Up is looking for Rachel Summers, who is also his friend and stuff, and she has been freed from Ahab, but now has been recaptured by Ahab, but may not have been recaptured by Ahab because he doesn't have her, because he's done something else. And guess who else turns up in this? This is queuing up for another one of those weird mutant crossovers where lots of things happen and nobody's sure exactly what, because Strife turns up at the end, because in the final part of this, you find out that Strife isn't happy that his reality is going to be winked out of existence because Nathan Dayspring Summers, sorry, Dial-Up, went back in time to try and fix the timelines and ended up causing a bigger mess than normal, so he's gone to kill Dial-Up. So the new broadband service is going to be called Strife. You heard it here first.
He's Cable's clone.
I know. This is Cable versus Cable versus
X-Men
Cable.
Comics are horrible sometimes.
This is some weird version of Kramer versus Kramer that I've never heard of.
That was a very good reason there's an entire podcast dedicated to just explaining X-Men plot lines.
Exactly. I don't know. I'm sure I read the X-Force comic, because while I was talking there, I was having to flick through it to remind myself of just specific details, because I couldn't remember if I'd read them in that or whether I'd dreamed them after eating some bad cheese. I don't understand. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it... I don't know.
What? Again, this is another one of the ones that I read when it was cut. And I've got to admit, I wasn't a fan. I think I dropped it after about 4 issues.
I read the
fifth. Did like the art, though.
The art's pretty good, you know? The art's very... I like the art as well, but I don't know what's going on. I don't know if what I read was good or not.
Basically, what's going on is a member of X-Force will yell, "Cable, you killed Cable!" And Dial-Up will yell, "No, I didn't, because he's me!" And then some things will explode, and then someone in X-Force will yell, Cable, you killed Cable. And they'll say, no, I didn't, because I'm Cable. And then there'll be some explosions and stabbing.
And then Strife will turn up and say, Cable, you killed everything.
Yeah, pretty much. And then Ahab sings a ditty about how he's a whaler on the moon.
Yeah. Oh, no, he can't. He's dead.
Well, thanks for spoiling it, Rob.
You read the first four issues, you know. Or is he?
I mean, going to say you've spoiled it for the listeners, but we don't have listeners.
I don't think they care. It's Ahab. I didn't even know Ahab existed until I read that Extermination comic.
Ahab is a guy who somehow manages to take being a robot pirate and make it uncool.
Yeah. As I said, it's the whole taking mutants and turning them into gimps. That's, you know, it just doesn't fit. And the Typhoid Mary comic that I did, it had a bit where, with the TV bit, where they turned Iron Fist into a pirate. I thought, this is actually really good. This is one of the bits that made me smile, you know, which is why I put it on the charity pile. Iron Fist as a pirate just kind of works. He's already got the bandana.
He does on the kind of split open shirt.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine him just basically on a pirate ship or, you know, hanging off one of the masts or some of the rigging going, there she blows. Oh, no, that's Whaley.
Yeah,
not
that, that tracks.
Yeah. So, yeah, Iron Fist as a pirate just works for me. So, anyway, yeah, this is going in the bin, by the way.
Fair enough.
It is definitely a sin against my brain. Are we done? Can I go now?
I think so.
Right, okay. If you want to catch up with if you want to catch any of our other episodes, you can find them all on our website or on Audioboom or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you go to our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, you'll find all sorts of other stuff and our reviews and various other things that we do. And until next week, I've been Rob, and now I'm going to go lie down.
I've been the slightly less emotionally broken Andrew.
And I've been actually quite chipper at the end of all this. Mick.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye now.
Okay, Rob.
Do you need a hug?
It's a horrible, horrible comic. I don't know what's going on.